Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce the speaker tonight, William Damon, author of The Power of Ideals, along with Ann Colby, The Real Story of Moral Choice. I'll give you Bill's background. William Damon is professor of education at Stanford University and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace. He's the author of 18 books, including Greater Expectations, which won the Parents' Choice Book Award. Professor Damon's research has been covered in many national publications, including the Boston Globe, the New York Times, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. His national talk show appearances include The Diane Rehm Show, Oprah, The O'Reilly Factor, Talk of the Nation, and the Commonwealth Club of California. Professor Ann Colby is consulting professor at Stanford University. Previously, she was senior scholar at the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching and director of the Murray Research Center at Harvard University. Colby is the recipient of the Kuhmerker Award for the Association of Moral Education for Lifetime Achievement in the Field of Moral Development and is an author of 9 books, including Rethinking Undergraduate Business Education, which won the Frederick Ness Book Award from the Association of American Colleges and Universities. Her research has been covered in national publications such as the Chronicle of Higher Education, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. And Anne will be contributing to the Q&A afterwards. So without further ado, Professor Damon.
Thank you very much, George. It's a real pleasure to be at the Commonwealth Club. It's a place that I admire a lot, and I've never spoken here before, so it's a great pleasure, and thank you very much, George, for the invitation and the introduction. And the first thing I would like to do is to introduce my co-author, Anne, who In every way, this book was an equal authorship, and the only reason that it has the order of authorship that it has is that Anne and I have done a previous book together, which was entitled Some Do Care by Anne Colby and William Damon. And we did not want to get the two books confused. Other than that, they were both as equal as could be. Well, Anne and I have both been, for our entire careers, fascinated by the subject of morality, which, if you think about it, is a kind of a mystery. It's a mystery with a lot of drama in it. In fact, most good plays or movies are about moral dilemmas, or will this guy or this woman do the right thing, or why does the person do the right thing, or will good win out over evil? I mean, there's a lot of drama and mystery, and if you think about it, it's not exactly evident why people would do something for the benefit of other people or refrain from doing things that maybe part of them would love to do, refrain from doing things that would harm other people. And, of course, those are both moral choices. And they cut against a lot of our self-interested preferences in life. And so, as I said, what a lot of the studies and work and thinking that Anne and I have both done over the years is to try to understand this mystery, especially the mystery of moral commitment, which is not just why somebody does something once, jump off a bridge to save somebody who's fallen in the river, or given some money once to charity. All of these are commendable things, but why people, some people anyway, are committed in a way that they stick with it for year after year, and it develops into a pattern with persistence and some courage. And this is curious, it's interesting, and it's really important for the kind of society that we have, that people do these things, that people are encouraged to do these things, that young people learn to do these things. And what has brought us here and what the subject of our book is that there is a lot of interest in this question today, but it's interest that has taken a kind of a strange and, to us, disturbing turn, which is, and this is really what I'm going to be talking about tonight, which is, number one, the idea of moral choice as it is being studied these days is about things that we barely recognize as part of the moral domain that we are so interested and deeply committed to. What is the moral domain? It's everything from ordinary kind of behaviors like, will you be responsible on your job? Will you take good care of your family? Will you every now and then do something for your community that is valuable? Will you not do things that are antisocial? These are common events. Sometimes they're heroic. Sometimes they do involve somebody throwing themselves into the breach and at risk of life and limb. But more commonly, they're ordinary, everyday kinds of commitments that you make small sacrifices. You do things not with yourself in mind. It's not all about you, but with other people in mind. But the thing that's fascinated people today, and it, this is beyond academic work, but covered widely in the media, in all of the kind of newspapers or NPR talk shows, the thing that seems to be fascinating people is something called the new science of morality, the new science of moral psychology. And let me tell you just a little bit about this. And let's see. It starts with a few assumptions that, number one, I think, assumptions that give us a particular kind of view of human nature, which is not exactly an inspiring view of human nature. It emphasizes the importance of inborn moral intuitions, evolved responses, baked into the brain, into the neurological system, into the emotional system, into the hormonal system. It emphasizes the socially functional nature of morality, which is the idea that morality is something that's used to adapt to the world, to get along with other people. And the one of the phrases that has come out of one of the best-known studies of this is the idea that it's called the emotional dog and the rational tail. It's the idea that our choices are driven by our emotions. And anything that you do to explain it or to justify it or to think about it in a conscious way is post hoc. That's the tail that gets wagged. It's a way of kind of justifying what you would have done anyway because you are driven to do it. You're driven to do it by an emotional system that's inborn or that is adapting to the social world that you're seeing. And that's the idea that it's post hoc, it's after the fact. You do something quickly, you do something automatically. It's a blink-like kind of response. And you do this because it's who you are programmed to be. And there's species-wide response systems that are built in. And then to justify it, to explain it to other people, to make yourself feel proud of yourself, you might talk about justice, you might talk about beliefs, you might talk about faith, but all of these are post hoc rationalizations. And I'll give you just a little tour through some of the evidence that people are using to promote this point of view. And as I said, this has absolutely captivated the media. You can't read a story about moral studies in the Science Times or hear the NPR version of it without hearing about the kind of research that I'm about to tell you about. The most probably common methodology that's used is an interesting dilemma that was really written by philosophers, and it was meant to illustrate issues about utilitarianism and other philosophical distinctions. But psychologists have picked it up to try to find out how people respond to a moral crisis or a moral dilemma. The situation, very briefly, and there's a number of versions of this, but a pared-down version is there's a runaway trolley car. It's lost its brakes, and it's moving down the tracks, and there are, unfortunately, five hapless people on the tracks that are bound to be hit by this trolley car and killed. And if you're the conductor or if you have somehow the lever to move it, would you change the direction of the trolley car? Would you take that action if you knew it was going to veer in the direction of just one person on a separate track? So five versus one. That's usually a pretty simple dilemma for people to solve, and they very often say, yeah, of course I'd kill one person rather than five if that's the choice. But the kicker is that there's an alternative version of the dilemma where there's a fat person sitting on a bridge who you could push in the way of the trolley car onto the tracks, making the trolley car stop, hit the fat person, that person is dead, and the five people are saved. That people are not so willing to do. In other words, if you put yourself in that position, would you push that person off the bridge? And this is used as an example of how people are irrational, because you would do it under one condition, but if you actually have to push the person, you're not going to do it. I'm actually going to make the claim in a minute, maybe I'll make it right now, that this actually doesn't happen very often in real life. But of course, I suddenly realize I'm in San Francisco where there really are trolley cars. But believe me, in most parts of the world, there aren't even trolley cars, let alone people sitting on bridges and five people, hikers walking down the track and all that. So that's one problem with this. In addition, a little bit less known, but equally flamboyant and kind of in its own way remarkable, are stories that experimental psychologists give about bizarre and disgusting behavior. And you might think the word disgusting is a little strong, but I'll give you a couple of examples of it. These are dilemmas that are given to people to see how they would respond to these, again, hypothetical situations. Well, I'll just say the incest looms large in these stories. So one story is a brother and sister who are off on a camping trip, if I'm remembering right, and they decide they should sleep together just to try it out. They're only going to do it once. They use birth control. Who's harmed anyway? And of course, people still are appalled by this, the subjects, and say, no, no, no. And that's, again, used as an example of people are, people are not really thinking this through, or people are not really making a choice based on a thoughtful sense of harm or anything like that. It's incest is baked into our emotional system, and so we're going to say no, even if it's totally harmless. The disgusting behavior, and I'm not making this up, is another version of this, is asking people about whether how right or wrong it is to have sex with chicken parts, dead chicken parts. And again, people, not surprisingly, are kind of horrified and appalled and say, yuck, are you kidding? This is wrong. And the psychologists point out, you know, who's being harmed anyway, which they have a point. The chicken is dead, you know, it's not. But still, so the other, so I want to, well, I, let me make the point right now that as proxies for moral action and moral behavior, these are not exactly representative of the kinds of things that really, number one, matter in the world and that are common and that we dedicate ourselves to. The things I mentioned before, things to do with family, work, community, society, right and wrong, obeying the law, respecting authority, being tolerant to people, all the things that that we care about in our daily lives, that if these are used as the proxies to make claims about how people come to be committed to moral actions, and if the claims being made are, well, it's all emotion because look at how strange people are these really good tests of that? Are these really valid as representing what we care about? And just a couple other things I'll mention about these studies. They tend to use college students, and there's nothing wrong with college students. In fact, colleges are great. I teach college students. They're wonderful. But they're not, you know, they're not the whole of humanity, let's face it. And they're not, I think even the college students that are here would admit, they're not fully, you know, experienced in life. You know, it's still fairly early in life. And, you know, so that's a limited sample. And a lot of it is based on fMRI imaging and so on. And the reason I'm mentioning that is there actually is some very interesting, valuable work being done with this technology. But it seems to me that one of the reasons that the media is just so fascinated by this line of work is the kind of scientism that's represented by this kind of realistic images that you get that can be scanned and analyzed through computers and so on. And there actually have been studies that have demonstrated that when research is reported as brain research using fMRI imaging and so on, the same findings will have more credibility than the exact same findings when found by other techniques. So there is this kind of aura about it that I think adds a kind of a weight to this line of thinking that that I am proposing is it doesn't really deserve. So just a couple of other issues about the implications and why does all this matter? The reason it matters is that, and my big statement is that it is lending a cynical view. It's adding to we live in a kind of a cynical time anyway, I think it's fair to say. But this is adding to that because it is disparaging a lot of the things that go into moral commitment, and it's giving us the sense that first of all it doesn't matter what we think. There's no real role for the conscious mind other than justifying behavior you would do anyway. There's no real room for the idea of agency, the idea that you're an active person making a choice, which then takes away the sense that you're responsible for your actions. Because if it's all part of your inborn biological and emotional response system, am I really to blame for doing something wrong? Or am I really accountable for doing something right if it's really difficult? And so it kind of throws a question into the very things that that most motivate us to be good, to do the right thing. And of course, once you're disparaging the idea of reason and consciousness and conscious choice, what difference does it make if what you think is true or fair? You're going to do what you're going to do anyway. And that leads us to the final question, which is, why would you even bother educating people? What are you educating? The mind. You're educating the mind. And if the mind doesn't make a difference in behavior, in action, or doesn't make the crucial difference, then does education even have a role? I have another wicked thought about the people that write about this stuff, which is, why bother writing books about this stuff if this is what you really believe? But I'll save that to the... I'll let them answer that themselves. This is the New York Times headline of there was a review of all of this work. There's always reviews of this work. It gets written about every couple of months. And One of the headline writers, at least I think, had a bit of a sense of humor about it. The amygdala, of course, is supposed to be the seat of emotions in the brain, and the research was showing how powerful emotions was. And so the headline writer stepped back and said, "The amygdala made me do it." And I think that kind of indicates my own and my own sense of skepticism about this line of work. In addition to this particular line of work, it's also built on another very famously deterministic perspective on moral choice, which probably most people in the room are aware of. These are the famous experiments that show that the situation is responsible for everything. So these are social psychologists. They're not the new scientists. They're people like Phil Zimbardo, who is in San Francisco, who ran the famous Stanford prison experiment that showed if you stick a bunch of undergraduates down in a basement, and some of them are prisoners and some of them are guards, the guards will eventually abuse the prisoners, even though these are all classmates. The Milgram experiment, which showed that people will follow whatever a person in a white coat tells them to do, even if it's electric shocking people and so on. And there are a bunch of other cheating experiments that show that everybody will cheat if given a chance. These are all situational. Deterministic. But this is an older line of research, and the interesting thing about this is that, unlike the new science, this is no longer covered as much. And a lot of the people who have done this work have actually modified and moderated their position. And for example, Zimbardo himself has actually created a wonderful program called the Heroic Imagination Project, which is based on education and saying, you know, you can do better by overcoming the situation through thinking and learning and control. And so he himself stopped his prison experiment because his wife convinced him that it was doing harm to the people. So he himself has proven in both his life and his work that we can do better than this. We can rise above these deterministic influences. And there's been similar work on the Milgram experiment where you can always find someone who refuses to follow what the guy in the white coat tells you to do. There's always somebody. And Milgram didn't report that out so much, but those people exist. And sometimes those people are the ones that convince other people what to do, not the other way around. So this is the conclusion you draw from the new science. We're not the ones that made up the "people are stupid" phrase. There's actually somebody that's written about this that says this is the "people are stupid" school of psychology. It's meant to show that people don't think. They're dumbfounded all the time. People are irrational. They're socially malleable, and they're crass and they're selfish. And we so what our book is about, and I'm going to just take you through a little bit of different kind of evidence, a different set of stories drawn from a different population with a different method. And just very simply, what Anne and I have done is look at some cases of people who have demonstrated already in their lives moral commitment. And we chose some unusual people, but we believe deeply that everybody has the capacity in our own small way, everyday way, to act and to learn in exactly the way that these people operate. But we did choose people who are very well known, and they were moral leaders of the 20th century. And, of course, one question I'm going to preempt right now is, in our book, we've examined very closely six moral leaders, six world leaders, really. But we chose six people. We could have chosen 60 or 600 people. There were lots of people like this. And we chose six that we could get good documents on, that we felt we could get some understanding, that represented a number of different things that we were looking at. But we're not saying these are the only six. There's nothing in particular about these six. And in fact, here's the reason. Here are the basis. This is how we chose these six people. And again, the first thing I want to say is that they weren't perfect. You can say every one of them had issues, as do all people. So we're not saying these are superhuman saints, but we're saying there's a lot we can learn from them. And what we can learn is they all shared a sustained commitment to moral purposes. They were all willing to risk their lives in pursuit of those purposes. And they were concerned with moral means as well as ends. In other words, they weren't people that just said, you know, I believe in progress and anything that it takes to get there, I will do, even if it's lie or cheat or kill. A lot of leaders, unfortunately, in history have acted that way, where the ends are supreme and the means are thrown out. And those leaders can even be totalitarian dictators. So we are not looking at those people. We're looking at people that pursued moral purposes in a moral manner, with truth, with justice, with humane concerns for other people. And so I'm going to take you just very quickly through these six people. And the first is Jane Addams. And what we did was we started at the beginning of the 20th century, and we went all the way to the end. And the first is Jane Addams. The last figure in the 20th century we picked was Nelson Mandela, who I'll get to. And Mandela was actually the only one still alive when we began the study. But we were not able to in our previous work, we've managed to interview some amazing people, but he was already too elderly for that. So all of the work that we did was based on documents, letters, biographies, autobiographies, and speeches, and the kind of things that all of these people left behind. Now, here's my agenda. I'm going to take you very quickly through these. I'm going to suggest that you, if you're interested in this, we go into the full stories in our book. And I'm just going to really drive the following point home, which is, I'll use it as a rhetorical question, which is, given what these people say and what they did, is it credible that they were driven by non-rational, emotional, stupid responses in their lives? Or maybe there was something finer going on, something that had to do with their beliefs. And the book and the talk is called The Power of Ideals. And the point that I'm making, and that we make in the book, is that the ideals really mattered, that the things that they found inspirational, the things that they dedicated their lives to, the beliefs, the actual beliefs, were for them the basis of their moral commitment and drove their moral choice. And I'll let you judge for yourself. And Jane Addams, of course, was the founder, or one of the great founders, of the progressive movement in the United States. She helped with everything from getting women the vote to getting kids out of the factories, 12-year-olds out of the labor factories. And she founded a great settlement house called Hull House in Chicago, with a whole new vision of social work, where basically, to say it very quickly, where it isn't the social worker working with a bunch of clients that are somehow dependent and subordinate and didn't know any better. It was a very egalitarian community where everybody learned from one another. And she was very inspired. But Jane Addams did not start off life as a noble leader. She started off as a very troubled and depressed woman. And she wrote in her diary early, "How purposeless and without ambition I am." And what did she do? She started reading a lot. She read Tolstoy. She took a visit to England, to London, and got inspired by the new settlement house movement there, and brought it home to her own life, and wrote in her diary, as she was doing this very pioneering work and difficult work and courageous work, We are under a moral obligation in choosing our experiences. We determine our ideals by our daily actions and decisions. These are her words. And you can decide, shall I take them at face value, or is she just mouthing these words in some post hoc rationalization of something deeper? I'm going to leave that as an open question. And as I say, if you want further depth on this, take a look at the book. But for now, think about the issue on its face value. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a very courageous Lutheran minister, who was an early opponent of Hitler and fought him and tried to convince his churches and fellow churchmen and women of his day to join the cause against Hitler. He was in the United States at the time when Hitler completely took over, and in fact he took the last boat back to Germany. He could have stayed in the United States and happily continued being a minister here. People loved his work and loved him, but he had to go back and fight, and he joined finally a group that attempted an assassination on Hitler. It was a very difficult thing for him to do as a Christian. He wrestled with this idea. The plot did not succeed. He was captured. He was thrown in jail and killed in a very gruesome way. But here's what he said when he was wrestling with this choice about, is this a Christian choice? When a man takes guilt upon himself in responsibility, he imputes his guilt to himself and no one else. He answers for it. He is justified by dire necessity. Before himself, he is acquitted by his conscience. But before God, he hopes only for grace. And this is a man wrestling with ideas, trying to decide, is this the right thing to do? And again, it would be incredible to think that this agonizing thought process that he went through actually did not make a difference in this incredible choice that he made. Abraham Joshua Heschel was a leading figure in the civil rights movement. He was, of course, a rabbi who in his work held his own fellow rabbis to account and said, you have to join this movement, this civil rights movement. And this was what he said in trying to convince everybody to join when Martin Luther King was still, now we look back on Martin Luther King as being a completely accepted hero. At that time, he had a lot of enemies and a lot of opponents. It was not at all clear in those early days that he was going to be successful. And what did Heschel say? He said, we forfeit the right to worship God as long as we continue to humiliate Negroes. Our churches and synagogues have failed. They must repent. The hour calls for moral grandeur and spiritual audacity. He calls for national repentance and personal sacrifice. This was not a popular position to take among fellow clergymen. In fact, it ruffled a lot of feathers, and he had a lot of opponents, but he stuck with this. Dag Hammarskjöld was the first real Secretary General of the UN. He was actually the second, but he was the one that founded the UN and gave the UN its sense of I think you could call it almost a sense of dedication to the all of the countries in the world. And Hammarskjöld himself died in a plane crash in Africa, trying to resolve a conflict between warring nations there. And some people believe that his plane might have been intentionally shot down. No one knows. But he was a very dedicated and courageous man himself, and a figure of inspiration to a lot of people. They're still in New York. There's a room at the UN, a contemplation room. There's a plaza founded in his name, and a couple of things from his diary, again, just to give you a sense of how he was thinking when he was making his commitments. never let success hide its emptiness to you. This is the idea. He was a humble person, and humility was one of the driving pillars, elements of success. At some moment, I did answer yes to someone or something, and from that hour, I was certain that existence is meaningful, and my life in self-surrender had a goal. This is what gives meaning to life, and the idea of meaning and the idea of purpose. Now, these are not ideas that are baked in. They're not genetic. They're not part of our biological. These are ideas that we construct, that we develop over time, and it takes a lifetime often to develop them. And it takes a lot of thinking and a lot of learning and something to believe in. And these people had something to believe in. Nelson Mandela, whose story is very well known since he passed fairly recently. And I'll just give you, I'll just say one thing, one quick thing about him. Mandela, when he was young, was actually quite an angry man, angry young man. He had a lot to be angry about, for sure. But he was not a peaceful disposition. But he was the man that came out of Robben Island prison, 27 years of unjust punishment. And what did he do? He preached an approach of forgiveness. And in his presidential inauguration, on the stand was the guard from Robben Island, his guard, just to show that he was forgiving and set that example for South Africa. And this is a famous quote from Mandela at his trial when he was unjustly sent to this long, and he could have been sentenced to death. But he said, "I fought against white domination, I fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and achieve, but if need be, it's an ideal for which I am prepared to die." And this is taking an ideal very seriously. And then finally, Eleanor Roosevelt, she, again, contributed so much, and it's well known about her efforts for minority rights, women's rights, and so on, labor rights, the rights of workers. The case that we look at in particular in the book is her fight for the Declaration of Human Rights, the Universal Declaration, which is an astonishing story. And 139 countries signed off on it. And these countries were at war with each other, or not hot war. This was in 1948, right after World War II, but it's when the communists and the capitalists were fighting one another, when the Jews and the Arabs were beginning to have a lot of hostilities. And yet, she got all of these countries to agree on unanimously vote in favor of 26 of the resolutions, and all but eight, and only eight abstentions on the other three, which had to do with economic issues, which there were some controversies about. And these were real statements. They weren't bland kind of abstractions. Things like slavery is always wrong. Arbitrary arrest. I mean, these are statements that set a charter for rights for the world. And yet. Every country signed off on it, but in their own way. And there were issues about the nature of, for example, families and the nature of kinship relationships and so on. And there were cultural differences. But they all were based on the idea of respect for human dignity and responsibility for that. And it was a remarkable document. It has set the... It's been absorbed into 90 constitutions around the world. No enforcement provisions, but it's been hugely influential. And one of the great anthropologists, Richard Sweder, calls it moral universalism, not uniformity. So it does allow for cultural differences, but there is a universal sense of justice, of human dignity, of right and wrong. And Eleanor Roosevelt was... more than anybody else responsible for getting this document accepted. And it was very difficult work. She was in Paris. She was up to 3 in the morning working with very tough opposing world leaders, and they were all men. And this was an era long before women's liberation or equality. And she did it. She stuck with it. Not an easy job. And I'm going to close with giving you just sort of a sense of how she bore up under the pressure and some of the ideas that she had. She wrote a prayer for herself that she put in her purse and said nightly when things got really tough. It would kind of keep her going. And here it is. It talks about, and in fact, I'll read it, and I'm going to end with this. He says, "Our Father, who has set a restlessness in our hearts and made us all seekers after that which we can never fully find, forbid us to be satisfied with what we make of life. Draw us from base content and set our eyes on far-off goals." See, again, these ideals. "Keep us at tasks too hard from us, that we may be driven to thee for strength. Deliver us from fretfulness and self-pity. Make sure of the good that we cannot see and of all the hidden good in the world. Save us from ourselves and show us a vision of a world made new." And I would propose that if we really do hope to move towards a world made anew, a world with a more just, a more truthful, a more humane world, that this is exactly how we're going to get there, by people who believe in these kinds of noble things. And we're not going to get to a world made new by just responding emotionally in a stupid way based on our hidden brain or something like that. We're going to do it because we believe in the right things. It does matter what you believe in, and we're committed to it. And we are making our choices based on good, higher ideals. Thank you very much.
So I'd like to remind our audiences that we're listening to Professor Bill Damon speak about his book, The Power of Ideals. It's time for questions and answers. I have a question. In what way are these ideals not in our self-interest?
Well, this gets to what self-interest is. They are in our enlightened self-interest in the sense that they are moving towards the kind of world that we would like to live in. But I will remind you that every now and then people are actually called to risk their lives, to even sacrifice their lives for ideals. That's exactly what Nelson Mandela said he'd be willing to do. And so if he had made that choice, and as I said, he could easily have received the death penalty, if he had done that, he would have said, I'm doing the right thing, I'm doing the thing I want to do. You can't really say it was in his individual self-interest if it led to his death, but it was in his self-interest in the sense that he was pursuing the purpose that he believed in. So in that sense.
That implies, it seems to me that unselfishness is just a more intelligent form of selfishness. That you're pursuing happiness, but you're pursuing a form of happiness that's more substantial. And so I think a lot of people, and not just at such big causes, are willing to set their lives aside because they still see it in their self-interest. They might not say it that way because the language has not been given, but I actually think that this use of self-interest for selfishness, and it's not in your self-interest to be unselfish, that language keeps us from seeing how clearly some of this stuff is actually in our self-interest and would be much more convincing if we saw it that way.
Well, I agree with you, but but your response, and I'm not trying to flatter you, but your response is an educated response. You know, you've thought through what is really in your self-interest and how to really think about what your self-interest is. And that's not the way everybody thinks about it. Obviously, people that steal, billions of dollars on Wall Street in order to buy themselves mega mansions are doing things the way they consider self-interest, and that's not your conception of self-interest. I'm obviously on your side.
Yeah, well, I guess what I'm saying about it is that yes, people cheat and lie and steal in the pursuit of their self-interest.
Right.
It would be very interesting to me if people realized that whenever you cheat and lie and steal in any competition, you're admitting to yourself and everyone else that you don't feel competitive. Because you're obviously can't play by the rules, and therefore, you know, that's what we all think about people in sports who cheat. You're not admitting that you're competitive. And if everybody thought of it that way, I think it would be much more embarrassing to cheat and lie and steal than it is now.
Well, anyway, unfortunately, some people are shameless and don't get embarrassed very easily. Yes,
thank
sir.
You for the introduction. I was an early fan of existentialism, so this idea that you're free is sort of an older one for me, but now it seems like we need to have examples of being free to suggest that you can be free. But certainly the evidence for how powerful our drives are is also something that should become something we be aware of, because
yes, thank you.
There is a lot of a strong struggle that we need to fight against. But another is that the ideals are difficult to pick. So there's a lot of idealists right now, and ideology has also gotten us into a lot of trouble. So if a Ted Kaczynski who believes in ideals and someone who believes in heaven or someone who believes in gun control or not or lots of guns can also cause a lot of grief. So what message do you get from these people that they knew that they were picking the right ideal?
Yeah, those are two great questions. The first one, if I had had more time, I would have said and talked about how much we actually can learn from some of those studies of our emotional contributions, because I don't completely discredit all of the data that has been found. It's just the only problem I have with it is that they're acting as if it's the whole story. It's all of our moral behavior. But certainly, as you said, emotions and brain processes and things that we're not conscious of play a big role, and it's important that we understand that. And so that line of research is helpful if you take it in that way. It's just that it's not the whole story, and it doesn't always determine what you're going to do. So thank you for making that point. And the second point, we would need another day to talk about how you can be certain of truthful, valid ideals. But I think you said it very well, that not only are ideals important, but the right ideals are important, because the wrong ideals can also lead to horrible, horrible consequences. And just to say it in a very short way, one test of it is truthfulness. And we have a chapter in the book about truthfulness and inner truthfulness. That's a test. Are you being honest? Are you trying it out and getting feedback from other people? Are you verifying the ideas with other people's feedback? Because you may be wrong. And as part of truthfulness, you need to be humble, and you need to be open-minded, and you need to consider when you might be wrong. And it's that testing that you hope to move towards a better and a truer set of beliefs that will work. And another thing I did not have time to talk about, but in the book, Anne and I write a lot about the virtues of humility and truthfulness that make it possible for us to try to get as close as we can to the right ideals, but again, in a humble way, always saying, you know, we're never sure. And all of these leaders had that ability to say, you know, this is the best shot. I'm going to take my best shot. It's the best I can see right now. I'm going to try it out. If I'm wrong, I'm going to learn from that. I'm going to listen to other people, and I'll adapt. I'll change. And I think that's how you move towards getting the right ideals. Yes, sir.
Thank you for your talk. Certain evolutionary biologists and psychologists believe that the emergence of morality and conscientiousness is not so much something optional, but evolutionarily necessary for human beings. The case in point being that we are the first species that has the capability of destroying not only ourselves, but the entire planet, and that it's a little bit more than coincidental that we are the first species that has this heightened ability to recognize right and wrong. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, and I don't know that much about other species, so I think I'll have to take your word on for it on that. It does seem to me that there's a lot of work being done on other primates, and it seems that the more we learn about them, the more we kind of discover that they are able to do things that we never understood before in terms of communication and maybe even consciousness. But as I said, I'm out of my league in that. That's an interesting statement.
Next question.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. Terrific talk.
Thank you.
I look forward to reading your book. I'm actually an economics professor from Cal, writing a book on Buddhist economics. Ah. And psychologists have had a lot of influence on economics in a way that I think is taking us in the wrong direction. So that, for example, behavioral economists look at subjective well-being or hedonic happiness, which is, oh, how much pain did you have? That's terrible. Stay away from pain. How much pleasure did you have? And so the focus is on pleasure and avoiding pain. Whereas if you go back to Aristotle and eudaimonic happiness, you focus on a life that's worthwhile, which really resonates with what you're doing and with Buddhist economics.
Oh, that's wonderful, yeah.
Right, but how do you... Okay, so here's my problem, because now, you know, economics is all about, avoid pain, have pleasure, more is better, and trying to get much more into... Well, the Buddhist economics approach is basically we're all one and we care about each other, you know, caring and sharing. But how do you change the dialogue? That's what I would love to learn.
Well, I would love to hear Anne's comment on that. If you could give her the microphone, she has a lot of great thoughts about that.
Well, I think one of the things that we do talk about in the book is that economics is another one of those paradigms that's really reductionistic in the same kind of way that these other ones are. Psychologists who've studied happiness have shown that there are different kinds of happiness, and hedonic happiness, which is all about short-term pleasure and pain, is in a sense the most primitive kind of happiness, and that the kind of happiness that's more engaging than that is when you become good at something, you're working hard at it, and so on. The third and most mature level of happiness in these studies is that you are living your life in terms of a sense of purpose, in meaning, and commitment, and what you really believe in, and so on. And so this completely separate line of research in psychology, Martin Seligman and others that have done on happiness per se, is very much aligned with what we're saying, which is that, sure, a lot of people are relatively thoughtless, are conformist, don't question their culture and so on, but that's not the way it has to be. We can see that it's possible to look at the situation that you're in or the culture that you're in and think about it and question it and work with other people to say, wait a minute, this isn't the way it should be, and it can be better. But if you assume that you're just a pawn of your situation, you're just a pawn of the reward, the crudest kind of rewards and punishments that are driving people, or that you're a pawn of your culture and determined by it, then there's no way to get better. So we believe that it's got to happen through education. Education isn't just for kids. This is a great example of education that starts from the premise that people can think and that they need to think. And if they think together and well and listen to lots of different opinions different from their own, and really think it through, and are willing to get behind what they end up really believing in, then we can make a difference.
Next question.
Hi there.
Hello.
I'd like a question. I have a question that's more like about the practical application of what you do with regard to, say, if you're the advisor to Obama himself, and given that America tends to be sometimes a moral kind of, or look to like moral authority out in the world, just given its might and scale. So something like the Syrian conflict or something like that, where you've got, you know, Assad's party, you've got ISIS, you've got supposedly Syrian rebels, and all those different parties feel like they have ideals. So the ISIS has been oppressed a lot of American history. But like, what is the practical application to say, what should America be doing more in terms of practicing its moral authority?
I think that's another great question. One thing is that the American tradition itself is actually built on some very noble ideals. And unfortunately, we don't hear enough about them from any of our leaders. I'm not saying we don't hear any. I don't want to overstate that. But the times when we really kind of thrill with a sense of that we are together as a country, and we kind of have a national purpose, are when people talk about the ideals of our Constitution. And there are two great ideals built into our tradition, the ideal of equality and the ideal of liberty. And sometimes these are in tension, sometimes these are working together. And I think sometimes when we drift apart from that and act in a way that what's called, you know, the real politics, and act in a way that whatever we're doing on the world stage or on the domestic stage, on the world stage it's about national interest, on the domestic stage it's about power politics, about serving the currying favor with particular interest groups. When we deal with when the political discussion focuses at that level, I think people lose a sense of belonging and pride and a sense of I really believe in what we're doing as a country. And when the leaders are able to articulate what it is about what they're trying to accomplish that serves the ideals of liberty, of equality. For example, during the Civil Rights Movement, which was the perfect example of that, where you were helping an oppressed group of people gain freedom and equality. And whenever we pursue a mission with those ideals in mind, people rally to it. And not just people in this country, but people around the world. People begin to admire the American tradition. And when we drift away from that into the realm of just power and politics and national interest and so on, that's when you start getting cynical and losing people. So that, if I were allowed into the White House to advise our president that's what I would say.
Hi, Bill. I have a quick question about education.
Sure.
So this relates to what Anne was saying, and then also relates to the question that was just asked about practical application. So it seems like obviously you're getting at this idea that education is really important. So I'm wondering sort of, is there a place for this idea of moral education in schools? And if so, like, what does that look like in today's educational environment, especially considering this sort of idea of ideals, and how does that relate?
Yeah, well, yes, of course there's a place for it. There may be less of a place for it these days than there was in our distant past, because when public education in this country started, it was very much about values and character, and if you look at those old McGuffey readers, they were full of moral lessons for kids. But we drifted away from that now, so we have to think of ways to get it back in. And one way that works, we have data on this, is the ideal of service, the idea of whether it's community service or volunteerism or doing something, or even working in the school for the community, and doing something that is giving the message to the student that it's not all about me. Because that's, you know, if you think about the environment these days in education, a lot of it's just about getting ahead, getting successful, getting into the top colleges, and I'm not disparaging encouraging students to get skills or to be excellent in what they're doing. I think that's important. But there's something beyond self-promotion that's important too. And when you get young people involved in some kind of service and then reflection about what that means, it's not just getting them to do the activity. It's getting them to understand what the needs are in the world and why it is it's important for me to be a good citizen in my society. So I think that every school can do it differently and has different opportunities, but that would be the theme, I would say, of the best kind of moral education would be getting kids to do something real that contributes something to people beyond themselves. And, of course, also, and I'll just one more sentence because it deserves this, and also refrain from stuff that isn't good, like dishonesty. There should be programs about cheating and that really get to why truthfulness is so important to build a trusting community. So morality has two parts, of course. It has the morality of giving and purpose and doing things for other people, and there's also the morality of constraint, of resisting the temptation to do things that are wrong, and schools need to do both of those. Yes, sir.
Time for one more.
In the first part of your talk, you were talking about some new science of investigating morality.
Right.
Did I detect the thought that a lot of it was pseudoscience? Like, for example, we're saying that fMRI imaging is mostly a construct and not to be believed, for example?
Well, that's...
Take it seriously.
It's a fair question because I think I might have had that tone in my voice about some of it, and I didn't really intend that because, as I sort of indicated a minute ago, some of the work is valuable and we have learned a lot from it, and I am certainly, some of my students use fMRI techniques, so I'm certainly not opposed to the method. I'm not even opposed to the new science research. What I'm really opposed to is the way it's been covered and glamorized in the media, which as soon as you show a brain scan, you know, everyone kind of goes gaga. And getting away with incredibly trivial statements, misleading statements about the nature of human nature, misleading statements that are drawn from experiments that were not even designed to tell us the whole story. And that is scientism, and that's what I'm skeptical of. So it's really the way it's covered in a superficial way that doesn't... And some of the scientists themselves, I think, are at fault for making too broad claims based on their own research. But some of the research is good, and the method has a lot of promise in the future, and we have a lot to learn from that, too. But thank you for the question. That helped me clarify that.
So I have maybe just enough time for a semi-optimistic analysis of this. And that is, you know, on the question about materialism, you know, that the material attitudes of the economics professors and everything are invaded. But materialism is an idea that's totally successful. And it's in its success mode. And usually any idea that's in a success mode carries everything forward with it. And it's applied to all kinds of areas that's not really appropriate. And part of it that is difficult that causes the determinism is that scientists are actually afraid of religion. They don't need to be anymore, but they're still afraid of touching anything that has anything to do with religion. And so they hold to determinism as a counter. The irony of that is that the most logical versions of most religions are deterministic as well. And so they're actually in the same camp. But society, human nature comes out very nicely when we're not starving to death and when people are relatively comfortable and therefore people aren't afraid of just surviving. And so actually allowing materialism to create that kind of society probably will make human nature come right back out in full force in another 150 years.
Oh, what a great coda. That's
so
great.
That's the way I look at it. So thank you very much.
You're here.
Even though the humanities are not that popular right now, they'll be extremely popular once all that other stuff is taken care of. Thank you very much for coming to another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 113th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you. Really, that was great. That was a terrific coda. I love that.